Stand by. Transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you so much for joining us this week. And you know what? We have a special surprise for you. Due to popular demand, we put together a show made up of some of our most memorable material, including interviews and topical pieces. We've had such a positive response to some of our past shows that we wanted you to have the chance to hear some of these interviews and segments yet again. So you know what? Sit back, relax, and enjoy all the craziness that's gone on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
A crime that is gripping the nation right now, and basically all over the world, is the case involving Casey Anthony and her two-year-old daughter, Kaylee, who tragically passed away a few years ago. Joining us on the phone right now to discuss what is going on with the case is criminal defense attorney and former cyber crimes prosecutor, David Seltzer. David, thank you for joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
David, can you give us a bit of a background of the case, just in case people don't really know some of the specifics that are going on with Casey Anthony?
Sure. People don't know what's going on. They're probably living in a bubble because this is all over the media every which way these days. But basically, Casey Anthony is charged with first-degree murder of her daughter and facing the death penalty in Florida. And trial is underway right now. I believe they're starting their third week. The case is completely full of circumstantial evidence. There is zero direct evidence linking her to this death of this child. The state's own experts and forensic medical doctors cannot and will not opine as to a cause of death. So far, the defense has come out of the gate with an opening statement accounting for the child's death and disappearance, which, in my opinion, completely saved her life, that being Casey Anthony's life, and that I believe the state will not reach their burden of proof for first-degree murder beyond a reasonable doubt, since the defense explained how and when she died, explained the 31-day period of why the child was not reported, and explained the smell of alleged human decomposition in the trunk of the car. So that's a summary in a nutshell.
Have they determined for real yet or not if Kaylee did die in the pool? Because I know that was the latest claim, is that she died in her grandfather's pool.
Correct. They have not, and they will not be able to do so because the evidence was not preserved.
Oh, I see. Okay. And now, with regards to Casey herself, you know, her character, or I guess examining her character, she's been all over the place. It seems that, you know, if you try to look at her, she comes off as a person who wasn't really sort of paying attention to her daughter, obviously didn't report the daughter missing. What kind of defense are they going to try to use to sort of get her off or prove that? I know that there's claims of sexual abuse now from her own father, the grandfather in the case, and now I understand they're trying to use that as a way to get her out of this.
Correct. They are claiming that she was sexually abused, and I believe at the ultimate end of the day, she will testify, and the jury will probably hear gripping and compelling testimony about what kind of abuse she undertook from her father's hands, and how she became brainwashed and afraid of her father, therefore how she had no feelings, and basically when her father covered up, or allegedly, if you want to say, covered up Kaylee's death, that's why Casey behaved the way she did, because she felt no emotion, she felt no sorrow, because she basically had it taken away from her father, who sexually abused her. There was even to go so far as to say that her brother was potentially the father of her child, and the FBI did a paternity test. So to say that this family has issues is to take it, you know, lightly and say it nicely, but there basically are issues there. Now, Casey Anthony can be a liar. She can be a lot of things, but just because somebody's a liar does not mean she's a murderer. And people have to understand that the state still has to prove this case. Now, no matter which way you slice it, there is no direct physical or otherwise evidence linking her to this child's death.
And in your opinion, David, again, it just seems like all the pieces of evidence and even just how this story has played out has been all over the place. You know, the 911 call that Casey's own mother made, it just seems like if they were trying to cover things up and that being the father as well, it wasn't handled very well, even though it's all so jumbled that, as you mentioned, the prosecution is having problems nailing down specifics.
Right. Every individual piece alone is a piece of circumstantial evidence. Taken as a whole together, you know, put it collectively together, call it circumstantial evidence of a case, that's what it is. The state is basically throwing everything up against the wall and seeing what sticks, because at the end of the day, the DA did not want to plead this case out, politically motivated or whatnot. They didn't plead it out, and they went to trial. This way, if the jury acquits her or finds her not guilty, it's not in the DA's hands. He did his job in his office, and that's the way the jury found her. So, you know, I can't tell you why this is going forward, but the way this is proceeding to me is just a train wreck for the state. But again, I may be in the minority. I don't believe the jury's going to come back on the serious charge of first-degree murder. I believe she will walk on the death penalty charge.
Really? And with regards to, again, back to her character, the fact that she, or that it wasn't reported for over a month that the baby was missing, and the fact that there's apparently, you know, evidence that she, you know, was out partying and all this sort of stuff. I understand a former boyfriend sort of is making these claims. Does that not swing the jury, you know, one way?
It may, but again, the defense is going to get up there and state, just because she was out partying and just because she didn't report her child missing doesn't mean she killed her child. The fact is, there is no evidence that she killed her child. So you only need one juror of 12 to say, you know, I don't believe the state met their burden. And I believe they'll get that one juror, because you have to remember, a conviction for first-degree murder carries with the punishment of the death penalty. I don't think 12 jurors can beyond a reasonable doubt, say this woman did it and find her guilty.
Do you
whether she partied for 6 days or 6 months, it's irrelevant. Doesn't mean she killed her daughter.
Okay. And do you think that anything will come her way? Do you think she'll be reprimanded in any way?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, she'll be found guilty of some certain charges and she will face some prison time. But to what extent, I don't know. I mean, even if she gets on the stand and says, yeah, I lied to the police, that's 4 misdemeanors. She's facing 4 years in prison or in county jail. She's already done 3, you know. But if the jury finds her guilty of a lesser murder charge, call it manslaughter, she's subject to certain prison terms. Maybe she'll get 15 years. Maybe she won't. I don't know. It's up to the judge at that point.
And do you think that her parents face any, again, repercussions?
You know, I think at the end of the day, the prosecution is going to have had enough with Casey that they're not going to go continue to look into this matter. I think if they lose this case and they lose this big charge, they may see it as an egg on their face and just close the book on it and move on.
So it's foreseeable then that like Casey may have some sort of minor charges, but that in the grand scheme of things, no one is really going to pay for the death of this poor little baby Kaylee.
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying the jury may come back and say manslaughter, which carries up to 30 years in prison, and the judge may find her and sentence her under that regard if the jury does find her guilty of manslaughter. But at the end of the day, yeah, if the jury acquits her, it is possible that nobody faces charges for the death of Kaylee Anthony.
And what's the tone down in Florida right now with regards to the case? Because I know that's obviously where it's emanating out of.
I mean, everybody's talking about this case, but it's not just Florida. It's all around the country. And a lot of what people are talking to me about is just whether or not this case should be in court. The evidence is so suspect, in my opinion, at best, that completely circumstantial with no hard physical evidence. Why is the state of Florida expending millions of dollars prosecuting this case? So that's really one of the big questions. But yeah, I mean, everybody's talking about it. It's in the media every day. But you have to remember, the jury doesn't see the media. The jury doesn't get to repeat the testimony. The jury doesn't get to hear anything. They're being sequestered. So the only ones really talking about it is the public. The jury who makes a decision is not talking about it, nor over, they're not allowed to discuss the case until the case is over.
Okay.
So they basically finish their case every day. They go back to their hotel and watch a movie.
And foreseeably, how much longer does this case have in court, Dave?
I think we'll be wrapped up within the next 3 weeks.
And how long do you think it will take the jury to deliberate?
Probably within about a week, in my opinion.
Okay, excellent. Well, David, thank you so much for your time today on the show. I really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
That's attorney David Seltzer. Again, make sure to check him out at seltzerlaw.com.
I ran away in floods of shame. I'll never tell how close I came as I crossed the Holland Road. Well, you went left and I went right as the moon hung proud and bright. You would have loved it here tonight. Spin me around just to pin me down on the cover of this strange bed. Spin me around just to pin me down. Wrap up your questions, keep them down. Let the water lead us home. And I was sorry for what I'd done. And you were young, I was not old. But our story was not told. But torn apart by greedy hands. Spin me around just to pin me down on the cover of this strange bed. spin me around just to pin me down. Spin me around just to pin me down. I'll be gone by the night's end. Spin me around just to pin me down. I'll be home in a little while. Lover, I'll be home. And I'll be home in a little while. Lover, I'll be home. I'll be home in a little while. Lover, I'll be home. And I'll be home in a little while. Lover, I'll be home. And I'll be home.
Your name is something special. It's how you're acknowledged each and every day. Now, some people love their name, and others are wondering what their parents were smoking when they came up with that name. Either way, your name says something about you. So to find out the inner meanings of our names is name expert and author Sharon Lynn Wyeth, who wrote the book Know the Name, Know the Person. Sharon, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for having me here. It's nice to be here.
Sharon, can you tell us how you became an expert on names and that you were able to write this book? Because I'm sure, you know, without a doubt, you've had some skeptics.
Oh, I've had many skeptics, but they become believers after we start doing a few names, especially when they're in denial and we're in a group and we'll start saying what the name means and everybody else turns around and looks up and goes, oh, yeah, that's you. And when they go, yeah, I don't do that. And they go, yeah, remember when. So that's fun. But I started because as a school teacher, how we see our children is very, very important because that solves a lot of discipline problems. And so once we get to know the kids, we rearrange seating charts and we do put a lot of thought and effort into them. And I was at the beginning of my 7th year of teaching and I get these random names and my brain started doing the same thing I do normally once I know the students. So I wrote down what my brain was telling me, and I put it aside until winter break. And when I looked at it, I was amazed. So I said, okay, my brain's picked up a pattern. I was a math teacher and a mathematician, so I'm good at patterns. And so I said, okay, subconsciously, we've got a pattern here, but I need to make it conscious. It took me 15 years, trial and error, and a lot of testing to come up with all the nuances and to come up with the patterns within a name. And then I went and tested it in over 70 countries for 3 years and wrote the book and said, hey, we could all do this.
Wow, that's amazing. And, you know, something that struck me right away when I knew I was going to chat with you today was, can you explain, you know, how our name said something about us as a person? Because a question I would have is that, you know, is it that we grow into our name or somehow our parents had this good intuition about what to call us?
I'm going to give you two responses to that. For all the scientific people out there, it is because everything comes down to a frequency and a vibration. And when that name is said over and over and over again, you are getting input with that vibration. And what I did was match each vibration that every letter makes with the sound into the corresponding behavior. So that's for the scientific people, and for the spiritual people. In when there was only seven religions on the earth before they all splattered and duplicated and everything else, every single religion believed that an incoming soul impressed upon the parent or the person that was going to be naming them what they wanted to be called. So in essence, we name ourselves, so of course it fits.
And what happens when parents, you know, parents-to-be decide to name their child before the baby has even been born? Like, you know, they've never set eyes on their child, but, you know, they've decided they're going to call him Christian or Robert or Olivia or Emily, but they've never even seen them yet.
I really believe that the child impresses upon the one naming them what they want to be called. And if they cannot get that through clearly, they'll use any means possible, going to somebody else, having an insight. And very many times, it's when the parent looks at the child after they're born and says, oh, I thought I wanted to name them this, but, I mean, they're really communicating with me now. This is their name. I mean, I have heard thousands of stories around the world how parents absolutely received an impression on what their child wanted to be named.
Joining us on the show right now is name expert and author Sharon Lynn Wyeth, who wrote the book Know the Name, Know the Person. Make sure to check her out at www.knowthename.com or bestnamemeanings.com. Sharon, does the way a name is spelled change the whole meaning? And do certain letters play a part in your personality as well? For example, you know, using lesser used letters like X and Q?
The answer is absolutely, because every letter and the position that that letter in corresponds to a certain behavior, characteristic, emotional response. Our vowels represent our emotions, and our consonants represent our attitudes. So even changing one of those is going to change a certain characteristic or set of characteristics, because every letter says more than just one thing. And X's and Q's, the X stands for basically, I want to do things my way or the highway. You know, it's like it's got to be my way, and I get very stubborn on and very insistent that I have my way on certain issues.
That's awesome. I have an X in my last name, so I'm all about that. So that's pretty cool. What is your take on celebrities who name their children unusual names? For example, Gwyneth Paltrow, who named her daughter several years ago Apple, or Ashley Simpson, who in the last couple of years named her son Bronx Mowgli. Are these kids going to be wild child children when they grow up?
Well, it always depends on the letters in the name. But with Apple, I would say she's going to be very much of a playful person who knows how to balance work and play, because the other letters in her name and with her last name really says she's got a tendency to be a workaholic. So it's nice that when her mom gave her this name that she balanced the workaholicism along with the playfulness, so at least she won't be, you know, just solid and serious all the time, but she'll have that playful attitude. With Bronx, Bronx is going to be a tough one to handle, because he's got to be at the top and he's got to be the best at all costs, and it's got to be his way or the highway. So he's going to make it tough on people around him, because he's going to be a little bit bullheaded.
Okay. And can you decipher some other celebrity names for us? Because, for example, everyone on my show knows that I'm a huge Janet Jackson fan. And so I'd like you to sort of tell me about her name. And a question that I actually had when I decided I would ask you about her name is the fact that she does have J starting both the first name and the last name.
Well, Janet Jackson, from her name, would say that she has a very good habit of surrounding herself with people that are smarter than herself all around her, because she relies on their intelligence. She relies on them giving her good advice. Janet main challenge within her name is to know her own value and to know her own worth. So she would be a bit insecure and want to work extra hard and able to overcome that. However, her name with those J's, especially in the placement on both of them, says that she's absolutely brilliant and she has an intuitive knowingness. She just knows things. And when people ask her, well, you know, a question, and she gives them an answer, they go, how did you know that? And she'll think to herself, how did you not? You know, because it's that natural knowingness that'll flow through her. She also would be very good coordinated with hand-eye coordination and with athletics because of her name. And she wants to make the planet a better place.
Wow, that's amazing. I think she'd be happy with that. And a question, too, for Lady Gaga, because her real name is Stephanie Germanotta, but, you know, everyone calls her Lady Gaga. I'm assuming her family, her immediate family does not, but I know that she has millions of fans worldwide, and that's what they call her. Or, you know, I think some of them look up to her as their mother monster. So she's got, like, three different names going on.
Well, when I look at all of her names, I will say that in private, she's very persistent, can be a little bit stubborn at times, but she's always been a little different. She's always had to figure out how to fit in, and that's what her birth name says. And then when she goes by Lady Gaga, what she's really saying is, I'm likable, I work hard, and I'm all about change. People need to be flexible. We need to come out with different changes. We need to be more adaptable. We need to be more accepting. And in her work, not in her birth name, which is her, you know, non-public life, but in her work, she would be highly sensitive to criticism, and she'd have to take deep breaths and say, okay, I need to get past this and get over this. In her personal life, she doesn't have that sensitivity to criticism. It doesn't faze her nearly as much as it does in her work.
And someone who I know we all love, but who has gone through recent trials, you know, this last year, Sandra Bullock.
Sandra is another one that doesn't know her own worth and value, but is just a sweetheart inside. But I want to say she can be a bull in a china shop when she wants to be. She wants to make the world a better place. She's an expert in the different fields of her interest, and yet she doesn't move or budge off of her position very easily. And so if you're living with her, that might be a little bit difficult at times because she's just going to take a stance and stay there. And yet she's charming and likable, and she's not going to change who she is, though, and able to get liked. She said, I work so hard at becoming likable. If this isn't good enough for you, it's just too bad.
And a good old solid boy that I think, you know, people love so much, and he's always around, and now he's just got a new movie coming out from Texas, Matthew McConaughey.
Good old Matthew McConaughey is from my home state, so I'm always happy to talk about somebody from Texas. Matthew would be in his, he has letters of extreme going all the way through. He also says in his name, I learned from my past mistakes. I don't like to make the same mistake twice, because that would bother me, but making it once, oh well, we all do that. He has a tendency to be a real workaholic. He has to be careful that others don't take advantage of him or manipulate him because he's got a very gracious, giving heart. What he likes, he really, really likes. What he doesn't like, he wouldn't like at all. And he would be highly athletic. He would need to exercise almost on a daily basis or get some kind of physical exertion out there because as you look at his name, everything says, I am about family, I am about people, and I am about activity. I need to use and move this physical body that I live in.
And someone who has a, you know, a little bit of a different name, although his last name seems to be fairly common, big superstar R&B singer Usher Raymond.
Usher is an interesting person because Usher's a kinesthetic learner at the same time a mental learner. He would be very bright and very studious. He would catch on and work hard if he didn't until he learned exactly what it is that he wanted to learn. And yet, the most important thing in his name to him is the freedom for self-expression and creativity. But being a kinesthetic learner, he needs to touch, he needs to feel, he needs to experience. All of that's very important. When you look at the movie with Tom Hanks and Big, and he gets in that limo and he starts touching everything and playing with everything, which drives the people around him nuts, Asher would be the same way, and that freedom to do that is important to him, and yet he has learned how to contain himself so that he doesn't irritate other people around him with his behaviors. But if he's alone or with friends and comfortable, he's going to be just like that, feeling, touching, doing all of that. He's got a bit of a rebellious spirit in him. And when he works really, really hard, according to his name. And when he plays, he's just the couch potato. It's like if somebody else would go to the bathroom for him, he'd let him.
Wow. And something that came to mind as well as you were talking is someone who has, you know, who has taken or who was given, rather, their mother's maiden name to be their first, which would be Beyoncé Knowles, because apparently her mother, Tina, an offshoot of Beyoncé, is apparently her last name, her maiden name. So they decided to call her Beyoncé.
Again, it doesn't matter where the name comes from. It's the placement of the letters in the name and what they say. And Beyoncé's got all these really strong emotional vowels and really strong, you can do anything you put your mind to as long as you just hang in there and don't give up. She's also quite competitive, and she's had leadership abilities demonstrated to her entire life, and it's like she was taught how to own yourself, how to be a leader. how to present yourself. And out of that, she believes that she can do anything. She's learned how to nurture. And loyalty is most important to her out of everything.
And finally, you know, she's a celebrity. She's a singer. She's in the dance music realm. Her name actually, if you sort of look at it on its own, it's sort of it means something together, the two names together. And I wanted to know what you thought about this. Her name is Crystal Waters.
This is an interesting name as I'm looking at it, because it literally says that I need to be in charge of me. I can do what I put my mind to. Once I make up my mind, I'm quite stubborn. I'm flexible until I've made up my mind, and then I'm not. But I'm all about giving back, and the older I am, the more self-confident I get, and I learn from experience. But I'm really here to help others, and I'm really here to be of value and benefit to the other people around me.
Now, I want my listeners to have a good laugh, and or at least see if, because, you know, they've been listening to me for a while now. So what does Kelly Alexander say to you?
Basically, it says that you've learned how to work, and you've got a lot of people around you that know how to work incredibly hard, and that you wanted balance in your life. But you're a detective. You like to know people's backgrounds, where they came from, what makes them tick, who they really are. You know, you don't like mysteries in your life unless you're able to solve them. And so it's, when I say you don't like mysteries in your life, I'm going to say you don't like unsolved mysteries, because you go about trying to solve them immediately. You have natural leadership ability. You're a chameleon. You could fit in with any crowd, any group that you wanted to, because you have a natural sensing about you on what people expect and what's appropriate in the different areas or the different places where you are. However, in your own personal life, you would take a long time to make a decision because you want to make the right one the first time, because you don't like to go back and have to correct yourself. And so when other people are waiting on you to make a decision, that might drive them a little nuts. But you're an energizer bunny. Once you get started, you keep going. And so also in your name, you have graciousness written all the way through it.
Wow, that's it's funny that you said Energizer Bunny, because I think my parents would agree with you. They actually put me in karate at the age of 6 because they said I had too much energy. So there you go. So happy to have joining us on the show today, name expert and author Sharon Lynn Wyeth, who wrote the book Know the Name, Know the Person. Make sure you check her out, www.knowthename.com or bestnamemeanings.com. Now, Sharon, a question that actually came to mind, and I think one of the reasons that I actually sought you out to talk to you, is that the fact about the man in Egypt who named his child Facebook, it seems in part to celebrate the place that Facebook took in their revolution over there. What's that name going to mean to her? Is she in trouble? Is it going to be too weird for her? How's it going to go?
Well, as a business name, it works beautifully. As a personal name, when I was looking at that, it's like she's going to be expected different things of her. And nurturing and loyalty is going to be very important to her. She's going to have a tendency to be a workaholic. She's going to want to be in charge of herself, but she's going to not be able to see reality exactly the same way or perceive it as other people do. It's like she's going to be looking at things enough differently that I think she's going to have a hard time, even though she's got strong competitive skills and strong leadership skills, she's going to have a hard time to know what's real and what's illusion as she's looking at things. And that's going to be an interesting thing to watch as she grows up, because she's got this powerful name, but she's going to be living in a world that the rest of us wouldn't exactly call real.
And what do you say to parents when they are in the process of going to name a child? Because I know earlier you said that it's almost like things come to them, or their child is trying to tell them what they want to be called. Do you have advice for parents to be, or do you just say, just go with the flow?
I really suggest that whatever name gets impressed upon them, they use that name, because that's what the child wants, and I think it's important to give them that foundation. On the other hand, I would say let's look at that name and the different variations of what you can spell, how you can get those same sounds with different letters, and let's look at this combination of letters so that you can either help your child or hurt your child with the combinations. Or if you just know, okay, my child's coming in, it literally says in the name what to learn. And says, if my child needs this, then I need to be right off the bat teaching in certain areas. Also, the parents give the middle name. Now, if the strong enough first name, sometimes you want to balance that with the middle name. So besides working on the spelling of the first name, I help a lot of parents with what would balance that first name and help give the child the attributes to balance out the challenges in the first name and give it to them in the middle name.
That's fantastic. And I wanted to actually just ask you about that middle name. You know how some individuals choose to, for whatever reason, if it's religious reasons or, you know, they have a certain affinity to certain family members and they want to include them in their child's name. You know, is it too much if a child has like four names?
Well, in different histories and different cultures, as I was traveling around the world, there are cultures that give 6, 7, 8, 10 names. What you need to know about a name is that the essence of who you are is located in your first name. And if you go by your middle name, then it's located in both your first and your middle. Okay, your middle name represents intermittent qualities and characteristics, and they usually show up out of stress. And those are the ones that when we look at somebody and they do something, we go, wait a minute, where'd that come from? I thought I knew you. That's usually coming from the middle name. And the last name represents somebody's environment. So it's like you drop the essence of who the person is into a particular environment, and you see what comes out. And all of that together will give you a great idea of who that person really is.
Sharon, you have been fantastic, and I really want people to get a copy of your book. Where can they do that?
They can do that on Amazon, or they can do it on Know the Name. And right now, the publishers are having a sale on the book, and so it's a good time to get one.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Sharon, for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. And if your listeners join the add-in list on knowthename.com today, they'll get an added surprise bonus because I'll decipher some of their name for them and send them the email.
That's fantastic, Sharon. Thank you so much. That's name expert and author Sharon Lynn Wyeth, who wrote the book Know the Name, Know the Person. Again, check her out, www.knowthename.com or bestnamemeanings.com.
Capture your need for sound.
You've seen my next guest all over television and movie screens, including his starring turn in Karate Kid Part 3 opposite Ralph Macchio. He's also made quite a name for himself on daytime television, playing roles on General Hospital, Sunset Beach, Bold and the Beautiful, and most recently, the number one soap opera on television, Young and the Restless, as bad boy Deacon Sharp. It's a great pleasure to welcome actor, writer, producer, and stand-up comedian Sean Kanan to the Kelly Alexander Show. Sean, thanks for hanging out with us today.
Kelly, thanks so much for having me.
Now, Sean, I know you you have a very important message to share about bullying and all the work that you've been doing to battle this behavior, but if we could just sort of set the scene for a second, I'd like to go back to your childhood. Were you ever bullied as a kid?
Absolutely, I was. You know, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, I was on the receiving end of quite a bit of bullying when I was a younger kid. And I think that's what made it so surreal almost for me to find myself years later playing the bully in Karate Kid 3. Somehow my earlier experience kind of helped me, achieve kind of a sense of compassion, I guess, and understanding. And I just have always really hated bullying, and I'm very happy now that I've got the opportunity to hopefully make a difference and do something about it.
Now, as a kid, did you want to be an actor, and was that playing a part in why you were bullied as a kid?
Yes, I wanted to be an actor, and no, I don't think it did, because by the time I really knew that I wanted to be an actor and had begun to verbalize that to other people, I was probably around 14 or 15, and I had a kind of a weird metamorphosis in my life. I was a chubby kid. You know, I was a Jewish kid in an almost entirely, non-Jewish school. There were a lot of targets that were sort of painted on me. By the time I was 13, I had started taking karate. I had lost a lot of weight. I really underwent an outward change, but on the inside I still sort of felt like this chubby kid that was awkward and got picked on. I just wasn't a chubby kid getting picked on anymore.
And with regards to you actually landing that role, the role opposite Ralph Macchio, where you played the bully Mike Barnes, was your martial arts training a reason why, like a part of the reason why you actually got cast in that very special role?
Well, it was absolutely a prerequisite to have martial arts ability to get that role. It's an interesting story how I landed that role. I was taking karate in Pennsylvania, and my teacher in Pennsylvania joined an organization called the Japan Karate Federation in California. And the head of the Japan Karate Federation is a Japanese gentleman named Fumio Demura. And it just so happened that Mr. Demura was Pat Morita's stunt double. And as I came to know Sensei Demura, he knew I wanted to act, and he told me, he said, look, they're going to be doing an open call to find the heavy, the villain for Karate Kid 3. You should try and, you know, get in on this. And by that time, I was living in Los Angeles. I did have an agent. I think I had worked one or two small TV jobs. And so I showed up at the casting director's office, and I said, listen, I said, I'm a real actor. I said, you know, I'd like an audition, please. And I thought she would just be so happy to have a guy like me, you know, save her the trouble of this open call. And she said, well, that's great. You can wait in line with everybody else. And so I was a little bit dejected, but I mean, I was absolutely determined that I was going to get this role because I just thought it was perfect for me. And I showed up at the studio the next day, and there were like literally 2,000 people waiting in line to get a shot at auditioning. And, you know, there was Entertainment Tonight was there, and it was a bit of a spectacle. And John Avildsen, who was the director of all the Karate Kid movies and who had also won the Oscar for directing Rocky, was walking up the line with a couple of his assistants and a camera crew, et cetera. And he made his way towards me, and I knew that I was going to have a very, very brief moment to make a very big impression on this guy if I was going to have any chance at all. And as he came close to me, we locked eyes, and he stopped, which I knew that was stage one, getting the guy to stop. And at that point, he said, all right, we're going to do a little improv. And I said, okay. And he said, I want you to intimidate me. And I can't tell you what I said on the air, but I think that I was pretty effective at intimidating him. And he looked at his assistants and he said, I'd buy it. And the next thing I know, I was ushered inside the studio, and I was soon face to face with Ralph Macchio, and I would put on a sound stage, and they gave me some lines, and we had another audition, which was actually the screen test, and they proceeded to hire somebody else, and I was absolutely crushed. And I guess the other guy that they hired, they worked with them for about a day and a half, and it just didn't work out. I don't know if it was a function of him not being, you know, the right actor for the part, or that he couldn't understand the martial arts choreography, but whatever it was, he was fired, and they called me back, and the rest is history, as they say.
And what was it like sort of playing this awful bully, Sean? Because like you said, it was sort, you know, you've had the experience of being a child and being bullied. Was it difficult for you to get into that mind space? And because you were very affected. The funny thing is, I actually just saw the movie again a couple of days ago. They had it on television, and I saw you in the scenes. And you came across, you know, as very convincing. Was it hard for you?
It wasn't hard for me because it wasn't until significantly after the film had concluded, and frankly years later, that I really started thinking about the dynamic of being a guy that had been bullied and playing a bully. I think at the time that I was doing it, I was really just too into it. There was too much riding on it. I mean, it was a very, you know, intense experience. No, so it wasn't hard. I mean, what was difficult was that a year before, I was a guy in the audience watching the film as a fan. And I had to very quickly set that aside and you know, be able to recalibrate myself to understand that I was now, you know, an actor with these guys, and I had a job to do. And, you know, that was a little bit of an adjustment. In addition to that, you know, I had really not had a lot of acting training. I mean, you know, most of what I had was kind of, you know, some force of personality and charisma, but I didn't have a whole lot of training. I mean, I had just gotten into acting class. You know, for me, now I watch Karate Kid, and I kind of shudder because all I see is an extremely young, untrained, undisciplined kid. But you know what? It's also nice because I can see where I've come from there.
Joining us on the show is actor Sean Kanan, currently seen as Deacon Sharp on Young and the Restless. Make sure you check him out, www.seankananent.com. Now, Sean, earlier this year, you went off to Washington to lobby on behalf of the Anti-Defamation League on topics like anti-bullying and sexual orientation inclusion. Why did you get involved in this, and what are you trying to accomplish?
I got involved with the Anti-Defamation League because I was watching the news, and I remember that I was literally yelling at the TV screen. I was like apoplectic. I had seen one of these stories, yet another story about, you know, some kid getting bullied and ultimately took his own life. And I'm yelling at the TV, and then I kind of had an epiphany. I said to myself, you know, what the hell are you doing about it? And if you're not doing something about it, then you're part of the problem. And apathy is one of the biggest issues that, you know, I think it's one of the biggest evils in life is apathy. And I had received an email from the Anti-Defamation League, just kind of like a blanket email, and I decided I'm going to respond to it. And I responded. The next thing I know, I'm having lunch with a woman named Margot Howard, who is in charge of major gifts for the Anti-Defamation League. She goes out and she does fundraisers. And she asked me if I would be interested in joining something called the Glass Leadership Institute, which is sort of a select group that they put together. They train you for a year. You have monthly meetings. We have speakers like, you know, everything from hate crime specialists in the police department to prosecutors who do capital murders to, district court judges, you know, high-level judges. Very, very interesting stuff. And it culminates at the conference that we just had in Washington, D.C., where we had some brilliant speakers. I mean, no matter what your political affiliation is, you know, Republican, Democrat, independent, whatever, we were privileged to hear people like John Lewis, who is a representative who came from parents who were sharecroppers. We heard the minority whip Steny Hoyer speak. We heard Michael Oren, who is he's the Israeli ambassador to the United States. And it was just fascinating. And while the Anti-Defamation League is concerned with a lot of issues, one of the biggest ones is, the issues of Israel, its right to exist. It combats anti-Semitism. It combats bigotry and racism. And we consider ourselves to be the premier human rights organization. It's very interested in dealing with bullying, and now specifically cyberbullying. Because, you know, when I was a kid, there was no cyberbullying. And now it's given people the ability to bully people anonymously. And I think for some reason, people are pushed to the limits of their worst behavior, hiding behind the anonymity of the internet. And most kids now have cell phones so that they're constantly texting and they're constantly hooked in 24 hours a day. So they're not just getting bullied at school. Kids are getting bullied via text message and Facebook, et cetera. And, I just decided that was an area within the Anti-Defamation League where I really wanted to try and concentrate, you know, my abilities. And one of the great things about being on a show like The Young and the Restless is that it affords me a springboard and a forum that allows me to bring attention to some of these issues.
And do you think, Sean, that parents, schools, and communities are finally taking bullying seriously and that things are starting to change for the better? Because, and like you mentioned, this cyberbullying, people can stay faceless and it's just insane.
Yes, I do. I think it's significantly better. Yes, I think people are starting to realize that, you know, bullying is not just an adolescent rite of passage, that bullying is incredibly damaging, often resulting in serious harm, if not death, and it leaves psychic scars for people, you know? And so I think that educators are really starting to step things up. I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And again, I say, you know, no matter what your political affiliations are, I think we need to, you know, commend the current administration for having the first White House summit about bullying. I think that's great. And, I think another thing that's starting to change, and it needs to change more, but parents are starting to understand that when your kid is complaining that they're being picked on, or maybe they're just withdrawn and not communicating and talking to you, or if they're choosing to express themselves through Facebook or the internet saying, I'm really unhappy, I hate school, nobody understands me, I'm getting picked on. I think parents are starting to finally give that the gravity that it deserves. And you know, for parents and teachers, what they need to do, I think, is A, be very vigilant and look for these sort of signs. And B, be there for the kids so that they know that they can talk to you and communicate without judgment. I mean, one of the biggest reasons that I think kids don't go to teachers, don't go to adults, is they don't think that they're going to be understood. They think that they're going to be judged. And they also fear that the situation is either not going to get worse or it's going to elicit, you know, a geometrically worse reprisal. And if parents and teachers and adults in general create an atmosphere where kids feel safe to talk to them, I think that's going to make a big difference. And one other thing, and I'm sorry, I realize I'm blathering on here a bit, but I just think it's important, is that I really think that when parents and even other kids, when you see something going on that's bullying or wrong, you got to do something. And if you don't feel confident to step in and try and do something physically, which is understandable, you know, you at least have to, you know, verbalize a protest and, you know, say something like, hey, we're not going to tolerate it. That kind of behavior is not okay. And I think when bullying reaches a level where it's just utterly socially unaccepted on any level, then I think that we're going to see it begin to get truly eradicated.
Okay. I think that's fantastic. And I think it's great, like you mentioned earlier, that the fact that you have a name for yourself and you can actually bring attention to this cause is fantastic. You know, and being on Young and the Restless, that has such a good platform. And I have to ask you some Young and the Restless questions, Sean, because I know you have ardent fans. I am one of them. I'm a huge Young and the Restless fan. And I just wanted to mention, because if people have only been watching you either on Bold and the Beautiful and Young and the Restless, they may not remember that you actually were AJ Quartermain on General Hospital years ago. So you've been in daytime for a long time. I watched that show too. So Sean, is it difficult to be in the daytime genre? Because I know daytime actors work extremely hard.
It's difficult, probably not for the reasons that you may think it's difficult. I think people's assumption is daytime's difficult because the hours must be really hard and it's a lot of dialogue and that sort of thing. That's actually not what's difficult about it. What's difficult is I'm an actor. I'm not a daytime actor. I'm an actor. And it's difficult that sometimes there's a stigma that makes it difficult for me when I pursue other jobs. And that's difficult. You know, if people knew what goes into one of our shows, I'll just explain this for a second. When you do a theater piece, you rehearse for 6 weeks, and you have the luxury of really discovering your character and really being well rehearsed. If you do a movie, you shoot 5 or 6 pages a day. We shoot 60 pages a day. We get one take. And when you're working in that environment, it's just not conducive to getting the best final product possible. It is what it is. That's the nature of the beast. And when you do daytime, you know that those are the constraints with which you're working under. And I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that, you know, when you see good work on daytime, it truly is, it runs contrary to how the deck is sort of stacked against doing good work, if that makes sense. So I see a lot of really talented people in daytime, and I think sometimes daytime actors, which I don't think they're daytime actors, I think they're actors who happen to be doing daytime, I think sometimes people get a little dismissive of the people working in daytime, and that's kind of difficult. For that reason, I'm always looking to do other things outside of daytime. I'm starting a film May 7th, which I'm really excited about. I hope we get a chance to talk about that for a few minutes.
Yes, go on.
I do love working on daytime, and I do love my character. I wish my character was working a little more. It's been a little frustrating for me to have gone from working on Bold and the Beautiful, where I, you know, kind of consistently had a front burner storyline, to, you know, working 5-6 shows a month. But you know what? We have a large cast. We have a lot of people who've been there longer than I have. And so I'm fortunate and happy to have what I have. Hoping at some point that I get an expanded storyline so that they let me have the ball and run with it.
Sean, thank you so much. And I really wish you the best of luck as well with everything going on with the anti-bullying thing. It's been fantastic. I think you're doing a great thing.
Thanks, Kelly. Thanks, everybody, for being here.
That's actor, writer, producer, and stand-up comedian Sean Kanan. Check him out, SeanKananENT.com.
Bring on the remix.
Take me to the
much for joining us on this very special edition of the Kelly Alexander Show as we took a look back at some of the very cool people and interesting topics that we talked about over the last several months right here on the show. I want to give a big shout out to my technical producer, Esteban Vargas, for putting all the magic together. And before I go, I want to leave you in a very positive frame of mind for the week ahead. This quote comes from Martin Luther: "Faith is permitting ourselves to be seized by the things we do not see." Have a great week. If you have any comments or questions, Kelly@KellyAlexanderShow.com. You and I will chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.